under the federal environmental laws, the minister is able to consider the environmental history of the company and its executive offices that's applied for approval, and that's what the federal environmental minister and department did when considering whether to give Adani its approval for its big coal mine in Queensland. But what Adani didn't tell the federal government was that its CEO had links to environmental crimes in Zambia. And what our Freedom of Information request has revealed is that the department considered that Adani may have been negligent in failing to disclose this link. That's a crime under the federal environmental law. But instead of prosecuting Adani for failing to disclose this, they decided to issue Adani with a caution. They decided that it wouldn't have affected the recommendation to approve the project, and so let Adani off with a caution and with its approval.
So how could they decide that it wouldn't affect their operations here?
So what Adani has failed to disclose in its application for approval under federal environmental law was that its CEO was the CEO of a Zambian copper company during a time when that company was charged with four environmental crimes. So they did disclose that he was the CEO of this company, but they forgot to disclose that that company was charged with polluting a river and failing to disclose it in Zambia. Now, this is the sort of information about a company's environmental history that the minister is able to consider when deciding whether the company is suitable to hold an environmental approval. And the fact that Adani gave false information when asked, failed to disclose it, is the sort of thing that the minister should take into account when deciding if the proponent is a suitable person to hold the approval. But it turns out that the department, when told about this by an NGO, this failure to disclose these crimes, decided that the minister already had so much information about Adani's environmental history and all of the various environmental harms that it caused overseas, and 11 different non-compliances in Queensland, two of which resulted in fines, already knew so much about it that this bit of information would not have changed the recommendation to approve it, which raises the question, if failing to disclose previous environmental crimes doesn't change a recommendation to approve a project, what would?
Yeah, it's certainly a good question, because surely we are supposed to know about a company's previous environmental history to give us some idea of what they're going to do here.
That's the whole reason why the federal environmental law gives the minister the ability to request this information, and information that's provided has to be accurate, otherwise it's a crime under the EPBC Act, the federal environmental law. But despite the fact that the Department of Environment considered that Adani may have been negligent, that's the quote, and so therefore may have committed a crime, they decided not to prosecute and instead issued Adani with a caution letter and let them off with their approval. And I should say that Adani has subsequently denied that they've actually received the caution letter, which shows that the letter itself was so polite that they don't even think it was a caution.
So what sent you hunting for this information?
There's a lot of debate at the moment about Adani as a company, and about whether it is a suitable company to hold this approval. And so we put in a request for the department's consideration of whether Adani was suitable. So it was quite a broad request. We ended up getting from the department quite a lot of information, and as part of that was new information about how they considered Adani's omission about this history of environmental crime.
So did it surprise you to find this one?
We did already know that Adani failed to disclose its CEO's links to environmental crime. This was disclosed in 2015. But what we didn't know, and then certainly was surprising, was that the department had done an investigation of this omission and this false information and had considered prosecuting the company, but decided instead that the omission and the information about former environmental crimes would not have changed the recommendation. So yes, that was surprising and raises questions about what it would take under federal environmental laws to result in this sort of prosecution and to change the recommendation. I mean, if a company can apparently lie or at least provide false information about its own CEO's environmental history and get let off with a polite caution letter and its approval, it raises questions about the adequacy of our federal environmental laws.
So which particular federal department are we talking about?
This is the Department of Environment and Energy.
Having those two in together almost seems counterproductive.
Look, I actually do think there is something to be said for combining the two. You can have the people in the department working together on these things in a constructive way. It makes sense to put them in the same place. Where it can be an issue is where you have either incentives within the public service or political agendas that are prioritising coal and gas and other emissions-intensive activities when, you know, we know we need to be reducing emissions pretty quick smart.
Okay, well, that's actually quite an interesting position that you feel that it can actually be beneficial to have both of these two in the same department, but that,
yeah, it can be. Yeah. It depends on lots of things. It's not something I've thought about deeply, but certainly there are examples overseas of countries that do have much stronger climate policies than we do, where the environment and energy public servants are in the same department. The UK is a good example.
Now that you've got this particular piece of information, what do you hope to do with it? Where do you hope it will go?
There were quite a few things in the series of documents released that weren't released, that were redacted, and so we've put in a further request for the letter that Adani sent the department outlining its mistake and giving its excuse for its mistake. So that letter's been redacted. The department says it's commercial in confidence and Adani won't allow it to be released because it would damage Adani's interests and the interests of its CEO, which, of course, makes it even more interesting to know what exactly is in that letter. And if this is the basis on which the department decided that it was a harmless mistake, then it's the sort of thing that the public really should be able to see. So we've put in a further FOI request for that, a more targeted one that we'll probably pursue through the review process, which can take some time, unfortunately. The excuse that Adani provided was that they were unsure or had misunderstood whether their CEO's role in the Zambian company constituted an executive officer role. Now, this really makes no sense. So Adani had disclosed to the government that Mr. Janakiraj, Adani's CEO in Australia, was the CEO of the Zambian company and held numerous or previous executive officer roles at this company. So to come back and then say, after getting caught out for failing to disclose the crimes, to come back and say that they were unsure that he was an executive officer really makes no sense. And it's just remarkable that the public servants assessing this didn't pick the company up on that and didn't consider this to be evidence of potential negligence.
What sort of timeframes are we talking about? How long does it take to get these documents released?
The FOI Act has a series of timeframes in it. It depends on what kinds of exemptions the department wishes to claim. They can claim extensions for consultation, a 30-day period, then they can get 30 days extra, then you can get an internal review. I mean, I don't know how interesting this would be for your listeners, but certainly interesting for people like me who spend a lot of time thinking about FOI requests, but it can take a very long time and is one of the reasons why a lot of these requests don't go anywhere, and you really do have to be quite dedicated about it and follow it through and know which battles to fight.
All right, well, let's talk about the next set of FOI documents that you've got through, which is about federal ministers and officials apparently engaged in helping Adani secure foreign loans. What can you tell us about that?
Last year, we submitted an FOI request about ministers and officials making formal representations to foreign investors, and that included governments or private investors, recommending that they be involved in Adani's projects in Australia. So Adani's asked for help from the Australian government, and we wanted to know whether the Australian government had been engaged in helping Adani get money from foreign governments or foreign investors overseas. And it turned out that exactly what had happened. So this most recent FOI confirms in detail that Adani had requested a, quote, letter of support from the Australian government to be sent to a department of the Chinese government, quote, to help secure Chinese financing. This happened mid-2017, and it wasn't the first time. We've also discovered that Adani asked the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, called DFAT, to meet with Korea's Export-Import Bank in 2016, and they did this ostensibly to discuss the nature of environmental approvals for the mine. In both cases, what we see is a foreign company or a company ultimately owned by foreign interests asking the Australian government to take actions that would help it secure money from other governments. This is really quite remarkable.
I'm taking it that that's quite outside what the Department of Trade is supposed to be doing.
I don't know, to be honest. I'd be surprised either way. It would be surprising if this was the only case where they had done it, but I'd actually be surprised if it happened more often. I think that's part of what made these revelations so interesting, that it's not the sort of thing that most people would expect the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to be doing. I should say that the letter to the Chinese government that was sent was not from DFAT. It was sent by then Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce and the Trade Minister Steve Chobo. And this letter basically expresses the Australian government's commitment to the Galilee Basin, opening up this enormous new coal resource, even claiming that it would help the environmental outcomes in Australia's part of the world, which is remarkable, and then stating at the end, we welcome foreign investment, foreign lending to large projects in Australia. That estimate, just a few days ago, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade denied this letter was in fact a letter of support to help secure Chinese financing. They claimed that whilst this was what Adani had requested, the letter did not in fact do this, which Senator Penny Wong did not believe.
It certainly sounds like a whole lot of technicalities and specifics about what exactly words mean, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So again, is this sort of a normal thing that a deputy PM would do?
I personally don't know of any examples. The department had the opportunity to name other examples in estimates, and I don't believe they were named. Again, it would be remarkable if it was normal. I think this is something that most Australians would find to be surprising if it was normal for our public service and our ministers to be trying to help foreign resource projects secure money from overseas governments.
All right, now, the whole thing with Adani has been so drawn out and so torturous. Are you able to just give us a quick summary of where Adani is up to in attempting to secure funding for its mine?
So Adani has struggled for many, many years to secure funding for its coal mine in Queensland and the rail line that it's going to need to get coal out from that mine. It's had, I think the count is now something like 30 international banks, including all of Australia's big banks, and some of the biggest banks in the world, including big Chinese state-owned banks, have all distanced themselves from the project or explicitly ruled it out. And this is why Adani is really dependent on, or has been asking for, government financing. And so it's asked for funding from local, state and federal levels of government in Australia, and also has been asking for the Australian government to help it get foreign funding. It's been reported, at least, that it was claiming that it was about to secure funding from China, from Chinese state-owned banks. Statements from the embassy and from various banks suggest that is now not on the cards. So it's a bit unclear now where the financing will come from. Having said that, with government support, anything's possible.
And where is support up to in Australia? Like, who is still really supporting this?
As I said, there's been financial support for Adani from every level of government. So the local governments in the area have put up money for an airstrip for Adani, which the local councils themselves won't own. State government has provided a royalty deal, which is essentially a subsidised loan. It will allow Adani to pay some of its royalties a bit later on. The Queensland government, Labor Party, during the election, to some sort of spectacular consequence, did veto a federal loan that the Queensland government would have to facilitate through the NAIF, the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility. So that potentially billion-dollar subsidised loan is now off the table. But at the federal level, there's a prospect that it could be funded through EFIC, the Export Finance and Insurance Corporation. So EFIC could provide a subsidised loan itself, or it could provide a guarantee for commercial lenders.